Hi, I'm Andrew Rich, and if you're like me, you look at the state of modern wrestling discourse and think, wow, what a cesspool. That's why I'm here to tell you about Music of the Mat Remix. That's right, your favorite wrestling music podcast is back with a new format, where I bring on a guest and we play songs related to wrestling-themed topics. It could be a wrestling reference, a wrestling concept, a wrestling pun, things of that nature. Now you might be saying, Andrew, that is a very, very tenuous connection to pro wrestling on a wrestling podcast network. Is this just an excuse to hang out with your friends and talk about music and ignore the rest of the wrestling landscape? Yes. Yes, it is. So listen to Music of the Mat Remix on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network, available on Apple, Spotify, or your podcast player of choice.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener. Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling podcast network.
This podcast is a member of the Voices of Wrestling podcasting network. Visit voicesofwrestling.com to hear the rest of our great podcasts, as well as show reviews, columns, opinions, and updates across the world of wrestling.
To the highway, in a brand new day, gotta let it go. So
Faster, Fringo!
Stars tonight together. Hear what we want to sing.
Welcome back to Open the Voice Gate Terminate Edition. It's November 30th, 2025. We are members of the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network. You can find us on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network feed or on our own dedicated Open the Voice Gate feed, wherever you get your podcasts. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. If you'd like to donate to the show, click the link in the show notes. It'll take you to our redcircle.com landing site. You click the red box that says sponsor this podcast, and you can set up a one-time a reoccurring donation, no obligation whatsoever, but we would like to thank all of our previous donors. I'm one of your hosts. It's your old pal, Mike Spears, joined alongside your other host, KS Lowe, and we are coming with a kind of special edition of VoiceGate this week that we are just dipping back into Dragon Gate and talking about King of Gate 2025 as we are on the precipice of the semifinals and finals in Corkin this week. And KS, we just have a lot of kind of issues around the tournament that just makes sense for us to just do this whole entire kind of bundled episode talking about Dragon Gate and the King of Gate tournament that we haven't really touched on since we got through that first round. So I think you have the big news hit. So I guess I should just pitch it to you and the Voice Gate news desk about what all is going on in Dragon Gate this month.
Well, it's been such an incredibly newsworthy tournament, and because of when we did those days last week, which, by the way, greatly appreciate the feedback on that episode, and in particular, the list of the best years in junior heavyweight history that we discussed. I'm hoping that gets clipped out into a YouTube upload here shortly. I have sent the audio to the people that make that happen, but I'd like to continue that discussion. I really enjoyed that sort of stuff, and I enjoyed the feedback on that last episode quite a bit. But as we've gone on throughout the month of November, it seems like almost every day there has been a new King of Gate match, and almost every day there has been a new Dragon Gate news item. It's really been an incredibly busy month, which is an interesting situation for the company to be in, because as we talk about last year, we talk about this year, the November schedule leans very much in favor of an early start in Corkin, and in Kobe, but then for the rest of the month, you know, they aren't visiting Kyoto, they aren't visiting Osaka, they aren't in their usual hubs. Gate of Destiny looked different this year. So even though we're only 4 weeks removed from that Cork and Hall show, it does feel like a lifetime's worth of news has happened since then. So for anybody that is not entirely caught up on King of Gate, for anybody that feels a little bit out of the loop, we're going to go through all of the tournament matches from 11-16 through 11-26, which gets us to the semifinals that are going to take place in Cork and Hall later this week. We're recording this episode now, A, as a preview for that Cork and Hall show, and B, I am out of commission scheduling-wise for the rest of this week and for next week. So you won't hear my voice for 2 weeks. So I want to be sure that I get some King of Gate thoughts in before we get to the semifinals and the finals here coming up in Cork and on December 3rd. But for anybody that's missed any news items so far, November 9th, so we're going back a few weeks now, November 9th, it was announced that Homare was going to be off shows for the foreseeable future due to a shoulder injury, and that Coach Minora and Strong Machine J would be off the upcoming shows due to illness. On November 12th, it was announced that Ryoya Tanaka, who, won his first round match. He beat Homare.
Yeah, he beat Homare in
the Cork and Hall show that feels like it took place 7 years ago. Ryoya Tanaka had to pull out of King of Gate due to a shoulder injury. Thus, his 11-22 match with Yamato was canceled. Yamato automatically advanced to the next round. On November 13th, it was announced that Coach Minora had suffered a mild concussion and that he would no longer be able to participate in his King of Gate match in Nagoya with Masaki Mochizuki. That show took place on November 15th, and it was announced during the show that Genki Horiguchi would replace Coach Minora in King of Gate. He subsequently did, and then he defeated Masaki Mochizuki in that opening round matchup. On November 23rd, Kagetora was injured. This caused him to miss the 11-24, 11-25, and 11-26 shows. On 11-25, the Triangle Gate belts were vacated due to Homare's shoulder injury, and then Shun was also pulled from the 11-25 and 11-26 shows. On 11-26, Dragon Daya was pulled from that show due to a neck injury, and Yamato also suffered a neck injury, forcing a referee stoppage in his tournament match with Rita. So over the course of the month, we saw Homare, Coach Minora, Shun Skywalker, Dragon Daya, and Yamato all pulled from shows due to injury. In the case of Shun and Kagetora and Yamato, we have timetables set for their return. The rest of them, I am unsure as of when we're recording, when we'll see, especially Homare and Tanaka again. But my goodness, what a month it's been in Dragon Gate.
Yeah, and I think it's kind of worth noting that I right now, Case, have the giant master chart of Dragon Gate events per month, and excluding May of 2023, November 2025 is the most events that Dragon Gate has run in any month since March of 2024 or 2018. So we're talking pre-COVID. Different era. They ran almost 200 shows that year, but the November has really kind of become this. I don't want to call it like a death march of a touring schedule, but they end up having essentially only 10 off days during that month. And I think that it, as we've looked at how the schedule has changed over the years, Case, it goes without saying that the more times you're in the ring, the more opportunity that there is for just like a potential of, to use the Dungeons and Dragons term, to roll a natural one and critical fail. Like you have that opportunity each time you get in the ring. But when you have a schedule where essentially the starting this week, they have 2 days that right now they're in Okinawa. They will be in Korakuen, and then they have 3 days in Sapporo at the end of this week. So they're in the midst of the worst part of their schedule since Shima was around, essentially. And I think it's natural to have some sort of injury accumulation. I do think when you look at like Homare, that guy has had his shoulder taped up basically since he debuted. So
yes,
this was,
no, that's an injury that's been building.
Right. Yeah. And with like the history of shoulder injuries in this company and the trickiness about it, like it, you know what I mean? at a certain point, it makes sense, at least for how the tournament was booked in that first night, that Hamari takes the loss and then is able to rest up for it. But then when you accumulate more and more, and when you have things like just concussions pop up, and not to mention the fact that it seems like Japan has had a mini like epidemic happen over November with people being sick and being pulled from cards, not just in Dragon Gate, but like throughout the wrestling world. Like Taiji Ishimori does that Gate of Destiny show at the start of the year, at the start of the month, and then he's off like a week's shows in New Japan because he's sick.
Yeah, somebody was saying DDT got hit really bad by the flu this year.
Right, yeah. So I feel like that we have some micro things when we just look at the Dragon Gate roster and just like this glut of injuries and just card manipulations and frankly tournament manipulation that they've had to kind of go under. But there's also some macro issues worth doing as well. The one that I feel like I kind of wonder how much this one was like a set injury is Minoru, just because how, at least for me, before we get into the matches itself, how brilliant the Genki Horiguchi miracle run booking felt like during this tournament. Like it felt like something that they kind of were like, all right, we're going to need to kind of, we have this coming up at the end of the month. Minoru is not going to do this. We're going to have Genki go in here. He's going to beat Mochizuki because Mochizuki has Ganbare pro dates. So he's not making Okinawa to begin with. So we got to get him out of this tournament. And then you end up having just a really fun level of intrigue in a tournament that I think, at least for me, I have been of a certain mind of this tournament since February, Case, and it's kind of playing out the way I expected. So it's nice to have those, at least using like the Minoru injury to provide a little bit of intrigue, where some of these are just, you know, just bummers of situations, I guess.
I said the same thing in 2022 when Jason Lee pulled out of the tournament after a match with BB Hulk, and that paved the way for Coach Minoru to then get to the finals of King of Gate that year, where, not that I ever want to question anybody's head injury, because I believe Jason was pulled off of those shows due to a concussion, but I also...
I remember Hulk kicking him in the head with that. I buy that concussion.
There's definitely a spot in the Osaka match with... I mean, this is funny, you know, the amount of wrestling we consume, and sure, if you told me about Jason Lee versus BB Hulk in Osaka from 2022, there's a head kick in that match that I vividly remember, but it also worked out to a point where Yoshioka and Minoru ended up in the finals in King of Gate that year. And I did flag that as like, oh man, that they either really made the most of that situation or that was the plan from the start. And the Coach Minoru thing this year had a very similar vibe, where I do believe that Coach Minoru is probably hurt and pulled off the show for precautionary reasons. But it's one of those things that just I don't know of another promotion in the world that constantly makes the best out of bad situations. And I guess that's the interesting thing with the tournament this year and all the changes that happen and all the injuries and all the news to come out of it, is I think somehow Genki being inserted into the tournament was probably the most drastic change that we saw. You know, it's a disappointing thing to not get Yamato versus Tanaka. That match is interesting on multiple levels, but I think the inclusion of Genki Horiguchi is the thing that really shook things up the most. And I'm with you. You know, I think the three-match run, the Mochizuki match, the Skywalker match, and the Yoshioka match, they were all interesting in their own way. And as I look at this tournament on paper, even in 2025, long after you and I have both agreed that Genki's best days are very far behind him, I can't imagine this tournament without Genki Horiguchi. He's one of the MVPs for me this year.
Yeah, and I think also when you have Genki in there, you get to do the Genki kind of situation where Shun Skywalker gets to be very believably and earned losing 2 minutes to a backslide from heaven out of an SSW and like an outright 2 minute sprint. And Genki is the person on this roster for 20 years that you point to for when, if you need to have an upset in a knockout style tournament, you look towards. And he just kind of becomes like the Swiss Army knife that when you insert him in the tournament, you get Shun out looking as strong as he always does, but like maybe protecting that back a little bit and ending up having maybe not like one of those matches that at the end of the year when we're going through our top 10 list and the ultis that's going to make it, but having a solid quarterfinal performance against Yuki Yoshioka at a time where it's kind of important to stack those up, and he instantly becomes one of the most like key people in this tournament. And outside of perhaps Jackie Kamei, I think he is one of the more interesting figures coming out of this tournament just because of how important that quarterfinal miracle run ended up being for him.
It's just a thing that I'll always appreciate it about this promotion, as we exist in a wrestling timeline where the concept of lore and the concept of storytelling is mentioned more often than ever, and I think often misattributed more often than ever. It was 22 years ago that Genki Horiguchi went to the finals of El Numero Uno 2003 on the strength of the backslide from heaven. It was 22 years ago. And as soon as he got put in the tournament, I mean, I said it 2 weeks ago when we were doing the last bit of King of Gate coverage, I at that point, he had beaten Mochizuki and hadn't had the Skywalker match yet. And I was like, I think he's going to beat Skywalker, because we all know at that point, once he enters the tournament, there's a built-in story there. And even, and Jay was talking about this on his Blue Sky account, where all of a sudden it seemed like there was a real possibility that he could even beat Yoshioka. And if he would have beat Yoshioka, I don't think it would have surprised any of us. I think Genki Horiguchi versus Ishin would have been a fascinating King of Gate semifinals match. And for as much as I want new and I want youth and I want fresh, I would have been okay with that, because there is just a built-in story there that once you know it, it's ingrained in your system. You know exactly what's going to happen, and that's a welcome thing, and it's a logical thing, and it makes sense that they've protected this move for 22 years now, and come tournament time, it's still a thing that can beat former three-time Open the Dream Gate champions, and we could all be okay with it. I think that's great.
Yeah, and I think when you have a tournament that is 32 people deep, and you end up have, and it's a single elimination tournament on top of that, you need to do you need to do something kind of interesting to at least shake up one of the quadrants, one of the regions. And it's a situation you don't have when you remember the year that there was the 8-person Battle of Los Angeles, and it was like a one night tournament.
Yes.
When you have formats like that, like the a Super 8 and essentially one night tournaments, you don't have to think about like, okay, I need to have some interesting things happening in these first and second round matches and have like a little bit of a storyline to go through, because you're not booking for a full month. You're able to have it nice and encapsulated and enclosed, and whatever story you want to tell about the tournament, you're able to do it across the show. But having Horiguchi, and especially I remember us like talking when the initial bracket came out, and we looked at that quadrant with Kakuta Yoshioka, Takashi UT, Mochizuki, and Minora, and Skywalker, and Doi, like that 8-person quadrant, we knew how much weight was coming in and out of it. And at least going into the tournament, I always kind of had the idea that this is going to be the final Yuki Yoshioka as the ace kind of tournament run. But you still need to do something to keep the region interesting. And Genki Horiguchi is the magical kind of wrestler that you insert him out of nowhere into a tournament. And when you have those 22 years of history, you instantly get a card and to play that you do not have the opportunity to, and no one else in the wrestling world has an opportunity to play a card like that. And it provided like a necessary level of spice, because case, imagine how we would be feeling this Sunday morning if we did not have the Genki Horiguchi miracle run as a storyline through the early parts of this tournament. This would have been not a bad tournament, but it would have been like a lot of us kind of tapping our toes waiting for something special to happen, and Genki kind of encapsulates specialness in of himself.
I would agree with that. Real quick, Bola 2011, Willie Mack versus Chris Hero, Kevin Steen versus Dave Finley, El Generico versus Claudio Castagnoli, and Eddie Edwards versus Roderick Strong in your first round. Semifinals, Kevin Steen versus Eddie Edwards, El Generico versus Willie Mack. Your finals, El Generico over Kevin Steen. What happened to indie wrestling? I don't even think, by the way, I don't think that show sold out Reseda that year.
No, it didn't. And I remember
that was like a thing that it's like a notable anecdote in history, is that show did not sell out Reseda.
Yeah, in a year that Akira Tozawa turned the territory on fire.
This is right after Tozawa left, because his last shows would have been May. This was in August.
Right. Yeah. No, I did. There was a part of me that thought that he was going to come back for that Bola and win it, by the way.
Yeah, that's Hero versus Mac is something I'd like to go back and watch. That sounds absolutely delightful. You know, you're talking about Genki being sort of the spice that this tournament needed, and I get the sense, having not talked to you about any of the individual matches, but I get the sense that I'm maybe just a tad higher on this tournament than you are. But it's also one of those Dragon Gate things where when the blocks were released, and I came on here and said the same thing, I was like, I have no idea where they're going with this. You know, Yoshioka is by far the chalk favorite, but when somebody is that much of a favorite in Dragon Gate, I tend to try to look for anything else, because that's typically what this company does. And we talked about, is it going to be Homare's tournament? Well, no, he loses in the first round. Is it going to be Susumu's tournament? Well, he ended up challenging for the Dreamgate belt right before this tournament. And so now you end up in a situation where, you know, again, for those that maybe haven't kept up, this will come as a surprise to you, but your final four are Yuki Yoshioka, which was expected, Ishin, Gianni Valletta, and Rita. And Mike, this feels like it might be the weirdest final four we've had in a King of Gate.
Yeah, and I would say without two out of the four are the ones that I kind of thought that Rita is just Cinderella run. It feels like that this is one of those things that in 10 years, like, remember when Rita made the final four of King of Gate and all of that leads up to? But because, like, it just in this kind of format, I think this is one of the situations that you have with the knockout versus the pure league format. Like, you would expect Rita to be like a final night, let's see if he gets out of the blocks kind of guy, and then instead now we get Rita versus Johnny, the match that Rita wanted so badly last year and he got destroyed, and now we get that for a tournament semifinals. I'm not surprised with Johnny being this far, and I think kind of when you have a tournament like this, a Johnny Valletta makes a lot more sense in the booking versus the block play, where you're going to have to figure out how this guy's going to take X many losses or how you're going to have to creatively book out of this. Instead, you have Johnny now in a situation where it's like, oh yeah, no, he loses in the finals to the guy who is going to win the tournament the whole entire time. That's a healthy loss for him. And that feels kind of earned. Ishin being the workhorse is kind of the fun surprise that we saw last year. They had the opportunity to really put on the working shoes and dial back the shtick. It has some real incredible matches against Yamato and Junior and Corkin. And I think like he has like workhorse kind of tendencies throughout the tournament, especially the match with Kamei. He is a little bit of a surprise for me, but I feel like that in some ways it's kind of since Minora is out, now we need to have like that guy that's always going to be in the semifinals and the finals, and maybe Ishin kind of inherits that role.
Well, that's what I like about this final four, is for as random and side questy as the Horiguchi stuff all felt, this final four makes sense to me. And when you've covered the promotion for the entire year, you start looking at these matchups, and this feels right. You know, 2025 has been built around the idea of the Yuki Yoshioka comeback story. It wasn't rushed by any means. We've been doing this since the end of February. And I think on a performance level, I think it took Yoshioka quite a while, and understandably so, to find his footing and where he was at. And he's still a little hit and miss, but we've seen far more Yoshioka hits recently than we have misses. I think at this point, you know, he and Kakuta might not have good chemistry with one another, which is a very odd thing given how talented those two are. But I think we're looking at that situation there. You're exactly right. And I think this is necessary about Ishin, is that he has, I think, replaced Coach Minora in the pecking order. I think they have switched spots, and that's something that...
Yeah, that's fair.
I mean,
I'd agree.
I mean, that's a five-year conversation of you and I trying to figure out what tier Coach Minora belongs to and what tier he should be at versus what tier they're pushing him at. And I don't know, man, I breathe easier. My head hits the pillow at night a little lighter knowing that Ishin's in the semifinals compared to Coach Minora this year, because for as much as I like Minora, and I do like him as a wrestler, especially as a tag team wrestler, Ishin's better than him in every way. Ishin, to me, has been the most impressive wrestler in this tournament. Kame might have the better output. Rita is probably on the same level as Ishin. But there's, on an individual level, Ishin's been the most impressive guy in this tournament. I'm looking forward to going through his matches because I have a lot to say about all of them. But that makes sense that Ishin's there. You and I have been wanting to see more out of him. I talk about the fact that he's got that Kurt Angle syndrome where he's so good at being goofy sometimes that I think it detracts from him being a serious pushed wrestler. And throughout this tournament, we've got serious pushed Ishin. So that's wonderful. And then you have this long-term story with Rita and Valletta that they've really stuck the landing on. And I have to say, while I'm almost positive that Valletta is going to win that semifinals match, I think there's a real legitimate chance that Gianni Valletta is your King of Gate 2025 winner. I do think it's worth pausing for just a second and talking about the fact that, you know, Valletta's first tour, which is January of 2024 through May of 2024, is built around establishing him and getting used to this Bruiser Brody type figure in Dragon Gate. And then right when he's about to leave, that's when Rita comes back and Rita wants the singles match with him, which they set up for whenever Valletta returns. If he ever comes back, Rita, you're going to get your singles match with him. So they do that at Gate of Origin 2024, very fun match, which then bleeds into the losing unit member elimination match with Z-Bratz and Gold Class that October 2024 Corkin, which has a ton of great Valletta and Rita stuff. And you go to the early part of this year, you know, they've had two untelevised singles matches this year, one in March, one in April. And now you have the latest chapter in what has become, again, it almost speaks to the larger point that I try to make about Valletta a lot of the time, is he's just been masterfully booked. And this semifinals match with Rita is not just a semifinals tournament match where Valletta comes in as the heavy odds on favorite, but it plays into something that he's been doing since his first tour in Dragon Gate 18 months ago. I really like, for as odd as this tournament has been with the injuries, with the unpredictable booking, the final four all feels right. This feels very representative of 2025 Dragon Gate, which for me is a positive. It's a promotion that I've greatly enjoyed this year, where you have Yoshioka, you have Ishin, you have Valletta, and you have Rita. And as somebody that always wants Rita doing more, Rita being pushed more, I look at this lineup and I go, yeah, this feels right. I really like what they've done here.
And just to kind of underline Ishin's MVP performance in this tournament, one of the big things that I feel like we have, at least since Kobe World, we've had the opportunity to kind of figure out is the tenor and the actions of the new heel unit of Gajah Dokuro. And as we've seen that, like, the heel cheating, it's not as comedic, it is a lot more pointed. And I think you could see what kind of heel unit Gajah Dokuro has ended up becoming just from reading Ishin's tournament. He advances in the first round on the 8th against Luis Monte in a serious mode match where he has one cookie sheet shot, but that's it from cheating. He wins by reversal. He has to go to the low blow to eliminate El Kakui. I'd argue that's incredibly earned for the size difference that Ishin was going to have to get underhanded with him in that sort of action. So you have two completely just deserved and earned heel performances, and then you go into a quarter final that is completely clean and in the style of what you've seen in the Madoka Kakuta Dreamgate title defenses, that it's just heelness through action, not by trickery. And you kind of get a new appreciation for, like, okay, now we kind of, just by watching Ishin through this tournament as this new 1B or the 2 in Gajah Dokuro, you kind of get to this point where we are going to look at this Ishin versus Yuki Yoshioka match, and it's going to be interesting to see if we're getting the bruiser mode or if it's going to have to dip into chicanery to get it across. But I feel like that I've been spending the last few months kind of feeling out this heel unit, and just from Ishin's kind of performance through this tournament, and I think arguably you could say the same thing about Yoshiki Kato as well, but I feel like we have a total, like, a total awareness now of what kind of unit Gacha Dokoro is now 3 months in, just looking at Ishin in this thing.
Is there any chance that Ishin beats Yoshioka and we're looking at a Valletta Ishin finals, or is it pretty much set in stone that Ishin's taking a high fly flow on December 3rd?
Man, since Yoshioka walked back through the curtain, I think we could go back and roll the tape about me saying, I think we already know King of Gate 2025 here. I just don't see it happening for Ishin, but you do have the fact now that Yoshioka could get screwed out of this and he still has the direct win over Kakuta that they can go back towards. So it's not like a 99-1 just like a win expectation, I guess. I've been watching too much college football over the last few days, Case. The win expectation thing has been doing a number on me. But I do think that Yoshioka is still heavily favored with that, but with the caveat that there is the Kakuta card up their sleeve if they want to go in a different route and still have Yoshioka versus Kakuta in Fukuoka in February.
I think it's far more likely that Rita beats Valletta than Ishin beats Yoshioka.
I'd agree. Yeah.
Okay. All right. I think Ishin, and what I think we should do here is let's go through these semifinalists. Let's go through their matches.
Let's do it this way.
If there's anything else that we miss, we can backtrack to it. But Ishin has done such a valiant job in this tournament. We talked a few weeks ago about Lucha Ishin wrestling Luis Monte. I thought the first half of that match was stronger than the second half of that match, but it was one of those eye-opening performances where you go, God, if they shipped Ishin off to Arena Nakampon for 6 months, the guy's going to be able to hang with the best luchadors there right now. You know, he showed off another skill set that he has. So we talked about that Monte match. He has the Kukui match on 11/22 that you mentioned. El Kukui did take a dive to the floor that where no one caught him, and he did splat on the concrete in a way that was disgusting. Somebody in my DMs referenced it too. It's the most recent time we've seen that would be like Jack Evans doing a dive and no one catching him. This was Kukui doing a dive and no one catching
him. Peter Casa. Yeah,
Peter Casa would be another one. Just a completely disgusting dive that ended with Kukui eating concrete far more than any other human on a dive that he was supposed to connect with. I did really enjoy that, but it was another match where Ishin was sort of doing fat guy lucha, which I really, really appreciated. This was not a great match by any means. I'd kind of put it on the level of the Monte match, but I thought the individual performance of Ishin between the character work, wearing the El Kukui mask to the ring, having that ripped off, and then being able to hang, doing really far more of a Kukui style of match than an Ishin match, I thought was super impressive.
Yeah, and I felt that it kind of veered a little bit at a point of, oh, this definitely feels like the kind of matchup that you would see on a Bola tournament where it's just like, okay, these two guys, they're matched up together. This is just a casualty
of
the booking.
It's the first match on the third night of Bola. So they've got three matches coming and it's like, all right, they're going to do this for 7 minutes, get in and get out. But it worked. It worked exactly for what it was.
Yeah, and I'd argue that that Kukui taking that gnarly bump and then nearly immediately going for low blow German, it felt deserving. It didn't feel like you were cheated. It just felt like, okay, for Ishin to get through this makes sense. This is what he's going to have to do with it. And yeah, no, Ishin then brings that performance onto the quarterfinal. And I think that when we get to the end of the tournament, like, it's going to be tough not to say Ishin is the MVP. If it's not him, it has to be Kamei, just because of how strong everything has been with him.
You're exactly right. And so let's fold these two matches together, because I want to talk about both of them. The 11/23 Yokosuka versus Kamei match and the 11/25 Kamei versus Ishin match. I get the feeling, and we have not discussed this, you're probably really high on Yokosuka versus Kamei.
I am 4.25 on that. And then I am 4.375 on Kamei versus Ishin. Like, just
okay. I had to do the math on that. Okay. All right. Okay.
Yeah. You get what I'm saying? Like, it was not enough for 4.5, but it was better than 4.25. Yeah.
Fascinating. Okay. I thought I was going to be high on Kame versus Ishin, but you liked it more than I did. And let's talk about the Yokosuka match first. This is a match that I've really wanted to see for a long time. I'm very glad they did Yokosuka versus Kame and that it got as much time as it did. This was a full-on Dragon Gate main event. This could have headlined Champion Gate in Osaka if it had to for the Brave Gate belt. I mean, it had that level of seriousness. It had that level of build. It was a very long match. It tested what I will accept as acceptable leg selling in 2025. Kame really pushed me as a critic to an uncomfortable degree of whether or not I thought he was selling appropriately. Because this, I was so intrigued by this match when it started, because Kame has the upper hand at first and he's working over the shoulder and the arm of Yokosuka, and we've all seen that formula a million times, but I was like, oh, Kame on top, this is going to be really interesting. I look forward to seeing what they do here. And then things change, and Yokosuka takes control, and this becomes a prolonged and intense effort on destroying the knees of Jackie Kame, which is a very interesting position for him to be in, because a lot of his big matches have either been long tags and trios matches or these modern era Brave Gate matches that are maybe 7 to 11 minutes and you don't get a ton of drawn out limb work. This was not that. This was long drawn out limb work. And I just kept wincing at when Kame would make a return, he would, do a springboard or he would do a dropkick. And sometimes he would go back to selling immediately and sometimes he wouldn't. And I think I left this match thinking, okay, he did a very good job of having me buy into his leg is hurt, but he's working through it. What did you think about the selling of Kame in this match?
I thought that it was at the level of for me in knee selling and leg selling, I am of the belief that whereas neck and back selling, like that is something that I feel like has like a level of constant pain. As someone like I have, I'm approaching 40, I have like pack pain. Like it's just something that you just kind of always kind of there, and that's how I prefer the selling of this. I feel like with knee and ankle, it's more the things that you kind of work on it, and there might be moments where everything feels great, but then another time where it's just like, nope, up, that hurt, that one hurt. And I can forgive a level of maybe not coherence is the term, but consistency, and always like after each move working or showing the knee. I think that if you play enough sports or have done enough running in your life, you'll have times where everything feels super great on the knee and then you twist it one way or land it another way and then it shoots up and then it's totally fine after that. So I was totally fine with it. It didn't really bother me one way or another. The thing that got me in this match, Susumu's the work that Susumu did on the knee, and there was a sequence where Susumu had him in a form of a bow and arrow lock that he intentionally puts both of Kame's shoulders on the mat, so Yagi does a pinfall count, and Susumu uses Kame's kick out to use it as the momentum to flip him over into the Boston Crab. That I thought was one of the more brilliant things I've ever seen. I think that makes so much sense. And why don't more people use the kick out as when you're on top and you're working like a body part and be like, oh, I could use them kicking out to transition and use that force in this. I thought he was just incredible in this match. I was much more impressed with Susumu in this match than Kame, just because I thought that the way that Susumu worked that knee and leg was really the kind of knee work you don't get to see these days, because I thought the transition was incredible. When's the last time you've known someone do that?
I don't remember seeing that spot before. And I'm with you. And as we discuss this match, I think I need to bump this up a quarter star from what I originally gave it, because really digesting this match and thinking about it, you're right. This was sort of an otherworldly performance from Susumu, and credit to him. I mean, I didn't think he had any of this left in the tank, but we've had two really, really strong Susumu performances this month. So that's very exciting to see. But I particularly liked just the way that Kame would get momentum and then the way that it would be thwarted. You know, Susumu's the only guy in wrestling that does that move where he just slams guys knee first into the mat. I don't know. I don't know if he has a name for that. We've seen him do it a million times, but the way that he was able to recenter and gain control of this match just by being bigger and stronger than Kame and taking him, putting him over his shoulders, and then sending him down knee first, doing that repeatedly and then being able to follow that up with, you know, a figure four or whatever else it is that he was going to do, I really liked how dominant he looked. And again, the Kame stuff, while being critical of it, I do still think that he held up his own end of it. It was a very funny thing for me watching this match, kind of waiting for Kame to go off the rails and detract from this very specific sort of match that I was looking for, but it never happened. He was able to keep me engaged with his selling the entire time. And then, you know, you end up with this great finishing stretch where Yokosuka goes for the Yokosuka counter. That gets countered into the Torbellino. Susumu blocks that with a crucifix pin, and then Kame's able to come back with a Jackie knife. Just a great 30 seconds of furious, aggressive, intentional wrestling that gets Kame the win. I originally had this at 3 3/4, but after discussing it with you, I'm going to bump this up to a 4-star match. This is a memorable match. As we approach the end of the year, this is a match that I'm going to remember 6 months from now, a year from now, because it had such a distinct tone, especially because we don't get a lot of Kame singles matches like this.
Right, and especially the King of Gates that he's been a part of, he's not been in the position to have like the Eita 2016 where you just get the block that's kind of catered towards you, the TV schedule that's worked so that you are highlighted so well. You don't have that in 2025. That's just not the world we live in. And I think that having these kinds of matches and at this time is just something that we don't get to see from him. And as Kame and Ishin had their quarterfinal match on the 25th, you kind of had the two workhorses of the tournament come at each other. And Ishin, you walked into this match going like, Ishin has had to go to a couple depths to get out of matches against more physically, more imposing wrestlers. What's going to be it for Ishin when he's actually able to kind of implement his will against an opponent like Kame? And instead you get Ishin advancing after a JFK cutback and in a clean match and in at least for me what might be one of the matches of the tournament. I thought that the way that they've worked in a building that seemed to be very frustrating to be a Dragon Gate wrestler in, because they basically were in a live house where the pit was completely filled up by the wrestling ring, including like 6 inches before a big step on one side. And they kind of took advantage of like needing to be more specific in where they wrestled. And you ended up having what I thought was a real incredible quarterfinal match with Ishin getting into the semifinals out of that quarter.
Of the group of matches we're discussing from the middle of November to just a few days ago, this is the best of the bunch. I don't think there's anybody in America right now that could have a match this clean. That's what jumped out to me more than anything here was they did a lot of spots. They did a lot of things. The Susumu Kame match was far more simple, drawn out, a lot of stuff that took a long time to get through and process. Ishin and Kame just did a lot of things, and what jumped out to me was how clean everything was. I thought this was such a high level of pro wrestling. I was so impressed by it. I was so impressed by Kame. I was so impressed by Ishin. There's not one specific thing that I thought was better than another spot in this match. I thought the whole thing from start to finish was masterfully put together.
Yeah, and the pace that Ishin had to work at with the level of cleanness, I think, is the other side of the kind of performance, because this ends up being about like a 16-minute match, but unlike the Susumu match, which kind of in a ways was built like a traditional old-school Dreamgate kind of build, this one was, I would argue, closer to that Bravegate kind of standard. And it just like the pace that Ishin is able to keep up, given like that he is a functional heavyweight at this point. And the little storyline that we had throughout the tournament, that the JFK and Jackie knife, people are starting now to either cut back. So Kamei in a second round match has to, he goes for a JFK that gets cut back into a penitent from Susumu that Kamei is able to flip through with the Jackie knife. The Jackie knife this time gets that doesn't do it, and when he goes for the JFK crucifix, Ishin just catches him in that clutch. And what you kind of end up happening is that Kamei, as we saw in the Twin Gate build, was basically getting everyone, him and Rita, were just clocking falls everywhere with the JFK Jackie knife or the Retanic. And I thought it was kind of cool, like showing in this tournament that people are wisening up to this being like Kamei's big cards to play, and eventually in the quarterfinals that the JFK and the Jackie knife aren't enough. And I think that that's a little bit of depth in a tournament that we led off talking about 8 different injuries. And I thought that was nice and kind of impressive to have that as a bit of match to match and round to round storytelling.
I think, you know, we talked about the effectiveness of the backslide from heaven and how that's been a 22-year saga with Genki and kind of knowing exactly what's to come. And the nice thing with Kame is you see in the Susumu match, you see in the Ishin match, and you see in some of his bigger title matches. You know, hopefully we get more of this in this Twin Gate reign. I hope it's a very long Twin Gate reign between he and Rita. But the Kame finishing stretch and the Torbellino into whatever else it is, whatever follows that Torbellino, is starting to have just over the 5 years of his career now that like, oh, what's this going to be? Okay, Kame is going for the Torbellino. What's going to happen next? I know we're about to get a special closing stretch. I really like that. So that's I was such a huge fan of this match. I'd go 4 stars on this as well. I think if you're going to watch anything from this tournament, if you're rushed on time and you want to catch up a little bit before the semifinals, I think you can make it really easy on yourself. I think you can do Kame versus Susumu on 11/23, Genki versus Shun Skywalker at 11/24, and Kame versus Ishin on 11/25. And I think you'll understand the tournament, even if Kame, Horiguchi, and Shun are no longer in the tournament.
Yeah, because you get a scenario where, let's just talk about the other two quarterfinals right now. Yamato and Rita ends early after the Cocolero shot from Rita causes a stinger for Yamato. He tries to work through it, but he throws one more punch and goes like, nope, I'm not able to continue. So Rita gets into the semifinals based off of that. Yamato does not go to Okinawa. There was a fan who got into his, who got on him on social media, and Yamato just snapped and said, listen, yeah, I am not like other wrestlers. You will see, if I was able to be in Okinawa, I would have been in Okinawa, but my doctors will said I should stay out until Cork, and so I'm going to prove you wrong, buddy. But so that was the one of the other quarterfinals. And the other side, you had Johnny Valletta and Yoshiki Kato, where really for Valletta, it's a lot of what we expect for him in this kind of tournament. I feel like that the work that he had leading up to it was what you should do with Johnny Valletta. I mean, they are nothing but smart about how they use it. I would say that KZ versus Johnny Valletta in the second round was a little bit too long for my taste. I thought that Johnny should have put him into the dirt a little bit sooner, but you had a classical big man versus big man match with Valletta and Kato in this quarterfinal. And especially as Kato has really matured into one of the more powerful wrestlers on the roster, it was kind of fun to see this kind of quarterfinal where Johnny has someone that he can't immediately throw around, and Kato has to kind of try to just survive the Maltese madman.
I always find that whenever they put Valletta in a singles match, they're playing a very dangerous game, because I think the brilliance of the way that he's been booked is that he's never really been exposed. You know, the Monte Dreamgate match last year, Dead or Alive, was the one time where it felt like the wheels completely fell off for Valletta, and it was the one time in which he didn't look dangerous. And the goal with Gianni Valletta, babyface or heel, is that he always looks dangerous. And I think the Dragon Kid match in Kobe was a great example of a singles match in which he looked dangerous. I'm with you. I thought the KZ match was a little too long. The Kato match, even, I thought was a little too long. They got their point across. Big man versus big man matchup. You obviously don't get a lot of that with Valletta in this company because there's only so many big guys around, and normally he's teaming with them and not opposed to them.
Yeah, but and he has to sell for Kato in this kind of scenario where he doesn't have to elsewhere.
No, and so, you know, you have a match, the Kato match, that I thought was fine. I kind of understood exactly what it was going to be from the time it started. And Valletta got through it, which is what matters. And I think now you can go to a situation where you get Valletta versus Rita. I think Valletta would obviously be the favorite in that match. And then you're probably looking at a finals of Valletta versus Yoshioka, which is an interesting win-win scenario. Not to jump ahead here too much, but if it's Valletta versus Yoshioka and Valletta wins, I think Valletta versus Kakuta is a fascinating Cork and Dreamgate matchup. And I would really like to see that because I think it would push Kakuta to really come across like a champion. I think Valletta in that building and Corkin specifically is such an interesting wrestler, and I would like to see that. And then, as you mentioned, you also still can go back to Yoshioka versus Kakuta because Yoshioka has the head-to-head win that he got in the first round. If it's Yoshioka winning, then he's the guy that slayed Gianni Valletta. He's the guy that beat him, and then he has all this momentum going into the Dreamgate match. I think that is a rare scenario of a win-win tournament finals. And I, for as much as I love Rita, for as much as I'd like to have some sort of Rita miracle run based on the idea of him nearly crippling Yamato, I think the safe bet and the right bet is Valletta versus Yoshioka, and I think that's a win-win for everybody involved.
Oh, I'm totally with you on that. Johnny, they've been so smart about when he takes the falls, and it's very clear to me that, you know, letting the would-be A's finally kind of slay the dragon that only so many people have gotten a wins. And even when you look at someone like Mochizuki or Monte in that Dreamgate match, it was not necessarily like it was not like an absolute like, oh, you've cut the head off the dragon, you've killed it with fire, it's dead. And there's a part of me that I really want them to go with Johnny Valletta winning and then doing Kakuta versus Valletta. And then you have Yoshioka there still to afterwards to take care of business and to get the win back. But the other hand of this we're going to go out on a little bit of a trivia game here. We're going to be talking about this combined. So King of Gate and Rey de Parejas combined as one. How many people have won two tournaments?
Ever?
Yeah. Have either won two Rey de Parejas, two King of Gates, or a combination of both?
Oh, God. Well, okay. All right. It wasn't even on my radar of something to think about. I don't think Yamato has won a tag league.
Oh, we're just talking singles tournaments here.
Not Rey de Parejas? Is it Rey de Parejas?
El Numero Uno and King of Gate combined. Oh, so just okay. The single tournament. My apology, I probably misstated that there. But just think about King of Gate, El Numero Uno.
Okay, so two-time King of Gate, El Numero Uno winners.
Correct, yes.
Okay. Yamato?
No.
I don't think Mochizuki's won a King of Gate.
He won in 2006. Mochizuki won a 2000 and 2006.
How many total are there?
How many total tournaments are there?
How many? Okay, I don't know. Mochizuki, and I'm gonna say BB Hulk, but I don't know.
Masato Yoshino.
Okay. All right. Lost in history. Unfortunately, Masato Yoshino not at the top of anybody's mind anymore.
And that is my point here. Yuki Yoshioka winning this year would put him into that conversation with Mochizuki and Yoshino as the only two-time winners of a Dragon Gate singles tournament.
Which I think is both a high honor, but also that fits in with the way that they've handled Yoshioka post-excursion. You know, that right. Would not surprise me at all. Normally, a stat like that would give me hesitation on, okay, well, I don't think they're going to put him on that level, but I think they could put him on that level. It wouldn't shock me at all.
Yeah, though it does at a certain point, I think with Yoshioka, everyone is so entrenched with where they think about the guy that all this does is just provide ammo to both sides, basically, because to me, he should win this tournament. I thought he should have won this tournament for the last 10 months, and they've kind of set him up in that kind of way. But I also know, similarly, people who just don't see anything in this guy whatsoever, that just like, why are you pushing the guy that does not seem over, at least to people personally?
I find his 2022 Dreamgate run to be one of the better Dreamgate runs in company history. I think very highly of it. But while he's had some bangers, while he's had some really high level matches since his return, I don't think he's the safe bet that he used to be. He's almost like a basketball player who tore their ACL, and now you see flashes of what he used to be, but it's not quite the same. And that's not a knock on Yoshioka. He had a life-altering eye injury that has completely changed the way that he can train now. But if I'm thinking about who I want to, you know, go all in on from a company perspective, Yoshioka's not the bet that he once was, and I do need to see it with him. You know, I do need to see. I would imagine both of those semifinals matches, just knowing how they typically book tournaments, are going to be under or around 10 minutes. I don't think he and Ishin are going to go out there and be given 20 minutes to have a 4.5-star classic, nor do I think they should. But my eyes are going to be on Yoshioka more than anybody else on 12-3, because I kind of need to see that he can come in to a Dreamgate challenge as a hot challenger. And I'm just not sure that he can do that anymore. He has the most pressure out of anybody here, because we know what Ishin is, and it's not Ishin's time. We know what Valletta is, and I think we're sort of circling around peak Valletta right at this point. And Rita, one, I don't think he has any expectation to do anything, but two, I have no doubt that he'll rise to the occasion if he's forced to. If for some reason he's in the finals, he's going to be remarkable in the finals. I thought that Yamato match was trending to be a phenomenal, phenomenal match. Maybe the match of the tournament before Yamato got hurt. I really liked the work that they were doing. I don't think he's getting by Valletta, but if he does, I know he's going to crush it in the finals. And I don't feel that way with Yoshioka right now. I could see Yoshioka versus Valletta, for as much as I want to like it, and for as great as I think the booking would be that got us to that point, I could see that match not being any good.
Yeah, I mean, it's a big kind of open question with what you see or what these guys kind of put out for this as we move to the King of Gate finals coming up on the 3rd in Cork and Hall. It's a busy month. I just had this retweeted into my timeline. They will be on the network, so that Hell trip I mentioned before, they have the show in Tokyo on the 3rd, and then they have one travel day. Then it's a 3 in Sapporo, and I know they have a lot on the back end of that tour as well, if it's the same kind of way as it is. Yep, they do not get a day off until December the 10th after this Corkin. So it's a pretty intense run for them, and that will continue, that they then have the next Corkin Hall show, this traditional 2 December Corkin Halls on the 16th, and It's the TV is set up in an interesting way that does lend to, hey, Johnny could win this, and you do the return match on the 16th and then move on to the new year with the Yoshioka stuff. So it looking at the schedule has maybe shifted me a little bit towards Johnny winning. I still think it's going to be Yoshioka, but boy, does it set up kind of nicely to have that Johnny title challenge if they want to go that way.
Yeah, last year the King of Gate finals were obviously to set up the Dreamgate challenger for Final Gate. We don't have Final Gate this year, so we don't know if it's going to be a second Corkin in December Dreamgate challenge or a January Dreamgate challenge. If it's Valletta, I would think you're right, because I would think he'd be home for the holidays. So you would do Kakuta versus Valletta later this month, which I think would be super intriguing. And then, you know, you get into January, you do some sort of Decourage, Hodgepodge, Cork and main event that takes you to February, Uno Dos Trace, where they do Yoshioka versus Kakuta, which has been my thought process all along, is I don't know how they're going to get there, but Yoshioka versus Kakuta feels like the safe bet for that show and for that building. So I'm intrigued to see how they get there. I think Ishin, just because there's a heel champion right now, is the least likely to win. I would put Rita's odds at very, very slim. Yoshioka's got to be the favorite, but Valletta, I think, could very easily win this tournament, and I think that would be fascinating if he did so.
No, I am with you on that. If this was on Kalshi or Poly Market, I wonder if by the time we put this episode up, what the percentage change would be for Valletta if people were betting on Dragon Gate in that kind of way. But buddy, I thought we were going to do 30 to 45. We're getting out in under an hour. Anything you want to touch on before you get out of here for a few weeks?
I want to mention two things real quick, and then I know you got a hard out, so I'll let you go. But the Genki stuff again. He's got the Mochizuki match, which is not really anything, but it's fun just for the finish. And then there's the 11-24 Genki versus Shun match, which I my eyes bugged out of my head a minute ago because I was looking through my notes of all these King of Gate matches and I saw that I gave a match 5 stars and I went, wait, what am I forgetting? It's like, oh, I jokingly gave Genki versus Shun 5 stars in my notebook here because it was so much fun for what it was. It's a 2-minute match. You can make time for it. I highly recommend it. But then what was interesting to me was on 11-25, you had the Genki versus Yoshioka match. And I sort of expected it to be short nonsense and for it to be quick and for Genki to be put out to pasture or to win. And then the match went longer than I thought. And I sort of had to recalibrate my thoughts on the match as it was going along because Genki, for as much as I love him, I mean, Pink Genki Horiguchi is one of my favorite wrestlers ever. He is so far. I mean, 2019 was the last time that physically he really had anything to give. So as the match was going on, I was going like, all right, you know, washed up Genki. Here we go. Let's get this over with. And then the match kept going. And there's a moment where Yoshioka goes for the high fly flow. And Genki not only blocks it, but then he hits a beach break. And I don't know the last time.
Beach break out of nowhere.
He hits a beach break out of nowhere. He can't immediately cover Yoshioka, which is, again, just this man's mind working at a higher level. That small, brilliant spot there. So it's a deep 2 count. Yoshioka kicks out. And then from there, they have a really hot closing stretch. Now, this is not a great match by any means. It is 2025 Genki Horiguchi. It did take a long time to kick into higher gear. But I think I have to recommend this match as well because Genki gave more of himself and more of his body than I was expecting him to. And this was a very fun outing from Genki Horiguchi, a very good outing from Yoshioka. And I just didn't think that Genki had this much left to give at this point. So that match was 11-25. I would recommend that one as well.
Yeah, the important thing for Genki throughout this tournament, and I think like the real masterclass of what this is this Bits Hall, which again looks like it's hell to wrestle in, comes across really cool on camera. But this venue completely buys into the backslide. It is a bot near fall. And that's all that you need to accomplish when you have Genki in this kind of scenario. You have to you use this guy because you know the crowd will buy into it. And when your rational mind goes like, there's no way that Genki can win this match. Genki won King of Gate in 2012. We know he had the tank top on for years afterwards. He's not able to do that here. But the ability to have those moments, I feel like, make basically any Genki match during this tournament worth watching. Like I rate higher on Yoshioka matches to begin with, Case, but I liked it, even though it was kind of hard to do the Yoshioka self-fest when it's against Genki Horiguchi. I think that was the issue of the first half of the match, was Yoshioka has his formula and you can't do that formula with 50-year-old Genki Horiguchi beating you down.
No, you're exactly right. So, I super fun. I mean, you can get through all of these tournament matches in probably 2 hours if you go through them one by one. But the Genki stuff, the Kame stuff, really, that's the stuff worth your time here. I also quickly want to mention, we have vacated Triangle Gate belts, which is such a bummer because I was so excited about that team. And we are going to have a Triangle Gate League throughout the month of December, which will certainly get them some mileage on that Hokkaido triple shot. I would imagine that we're seeing headlining matches on all three of those shows. That probably works out nice for the booking team. But the teams are Natural Vibe, Strong Machine J, KZ, and UT. D-Courage, Yoshioka, Daya, and Tanaka. So Tanaka will be back starting in December. Love and Peace, Hyo Bin K, and Mochizuki Jr. Paradox, Yamato, Dragon Kid, and BB Hulk. And Gaja Dokuro, Kota Minora, Jason Lee, and Kai. Any thoughts on any of those teams?
I think the Gaja Dokuro team, immediately moving on from Ishin and Kato's, kind of pointed. The my bigger kind of takeaway about this league is, what the hell are you going to do with El Cielo right now? The guy only works in Cypatra trios and Atomicos, and the tournament stuff, of which they had him be eliminated by count out because he got his wrists taped. Like, what do you do with this guy knowing that Shun's probably back? I mean,
no, Shun's working. He was on the Okinawa shows teaming with Valletta.
Oh, he actually went to Okinawa, huh?
Yes.
I didn't know if the Rampage music video, if they pulled him back also for that as well.
No, let me confirm that. But Okinawa, yeah, today it was Hyo and Rita versus Valletta and Skywalker.
So I guess you'll have to do Cielo and Skywalker when Valletta's not around. But yeah, no, I feel like that you naturally have the thing of, is D-Courage finally going to get that Triangle Gate run? And I think that that's kind of an interesting kind of route there. But there's the comfort of putting it back on Gajah Dokuro that I kind of expect.
Yeah, that's sort of what I'm afraid of. I mean, Hyo, Ben, and Junior, you know, people know my thoughts on Love and Peace. I'm going to be pulling for them in this tournament, but I could also see them very easily finishing in last place in this league. I don't love any of this. I really, really like the Cypatra trio, and I'm not sure that I want any of these five teams that are in the Triangle Gate League to be Triangle Gate champions right now.
Now I'm hearing you. That's why I think that, why not put the belt back on Kai? Put it on
I almost want to just put the belts on Vibes. Just, just give them a spin around the block. Why not?
Hey, Vibes countdown. You're under 50 days until possible Shimizu.
Yeah, and you've got the Hokkaido stuff. So you'll have one of the shows headlined by Strong Machine J, KZ, and UT versus Yamato, Drankin, and Hulk in the Triangle Gate League, because you'll have KZ and Hulk, you know, in their hometown. So I don't know. I don't know what I would have done differently, but I'm uninspired by this league. I do not like the look of it on paper. Maybe if it was Yamato, Drankin, and Susumu, I would feel differently about it. But also because of the Hokkaido triple shot, I understand why Hulk's the one in Paradox. But I don't really like any of this.
No, I hear you. It'll be interesting to fill out a schedule that has a lot of network appearances, so it makes sense like that. Well, buddy, I hope you have a good few weeks, and I'll talk to you around time of this second Korkin.
Yeah, that's the next time we'll talk. We'll, I think, be reviewing that show. So I'll have a written review for the 12-3 show. My guess is that show takes place on Wednesday. You'll probably have to wait until Monday after the weekend to get my written thoughts on that. Mike will have audio coverage of it, and then I'll be MIA the second week of December on assignment for work, and I will return with a review of that second Korkin in December.
Sounds like a plan, buddy. Well, if you have not caught this episode of Those Days, that is out in your feed in the meantime. Kind of ended up being a somewhat Thanksgiving Day surprise or Travel Day surprise, but thanks everyone for the kind words about it and the time since then. You can follow us on social media at Open Voice Gate. Case is at underscore in your case. I'm at Fujiheya. Thanks for listening to Open the Voice Bat. Open the Voice Gate. We'll be back with you next time. Take care, everyone.
My name is Tyler Fornes, and I am one of the co-hosts of The Good, The Bad, and The Hungi AEW podcast here on the Voice of Wrestling Podcasting Network. We take a broad scope approach to the world of All Elite Wrestling and the entire universe of Tony Khan. We talk about the big matches, the big stars, the promos, the storylines, and we also look at it from a big picture perspective. How are things going to change over the course of the next 10 years with AEW still in the picture? How are companies like WWE going to adapt and adjust to AEW? Are they going to be a similar way like they did with WCW in the late 1990s? Will there be a counterpunch? We talk about all of that and more on The Good, The Bad, and The Hungi every week on the Voices of Wrestling Network.
Hello, Voices of Wrestling listener, Dave Ryan here. Have you ever wondered to yourself, how many hidden gems are hidden away inside the last years of World Championship Wrestling? Have you ever asked yourself how many tenuous gags can be made about the name Mike Enos? And have you ever thought about what it sounds like for two Irishmen to interpret a very chaotic company through its B-show? The answers to all this and more are just a click away. Check out Days of Thunder every second Thursday on the Voices of Wrestling Podcast Network.